Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Conscious Vibe Podcast,
where we elevate intellect through conscious dialogue
while exploring race, politics, business, and culture.
I'm Dr. Daryl L. Jones.
And I'm Charles D. Mitchell.
So, Charles, how are you?
Doing great, DJ. Good to see you again on camera.
I know, man. It feels a little weird, but we're all here.
Okay.
And then Daniel Madeline, man, how are you? Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, DJ. Hi, Charles. Hey. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, thank you. We're so glad that you're able to make it.
So this is part two with you, Daniel, founder of Is There Enough? And I tell you what, man, how does it feel? You are our first guest to be invited back for a second session. How about that? Does that make you feel warm and fuzzy?
It sure does. I'm really glad this conversation's getting enough attention that we see a personal stake in it, which is, I hope, why you have me back here.
Yeah.
And see where we can take it. So there's always a bigger onion to peel in examining what enough is and our place in it. So,
man, that's awesome.
You know, Daniel, I think that's part of the reason we wanted to continue this dialogue, because, you know, I think there is, you know, an important conversation here. And I think beyond just some of the things that are big topics that I think we all care about, I think the other piece that's important is, how do we actually get this into an actionable format? Like, what are some concrete actionable things that all can do? I've listened to some of your other conversations on video that are online, and you know, I'm struck by a word that you use fairly a lot, and I think very appropriate, but the word collaboration, and how that's important in trying to get to some of these solutions. So I'd love to speak about that a little in our conversation today.
You know, Charles, if we share the idea that many of our obstacles could be overcome through collaboration at a higher level than we're capable of doing as humanity, if that's a sense that we all have. Question is what actually produces that? Because a lot of us are talking about the fact that we need to come together, we need to look past our divides, and we need 1,000 flowers blooming on that subject. We need a lot of experimentation on that. We need an intention to find better ways than any of the ones we're talking about so far today. Maybe somebody out there is going to be inspired by that as an ideal, as a practical ideal, and get involved. Look, much of the stuff that you hear us talk about is derivative of Buckminster Fuller, and he had a phrase that the only failure in life is the failure to participate. And I think really when it comes to collaboration, we really talk down about there's not enough action. It's just like all talk and no action, and yet good action requires some good talk. It's like a baseball player we consider a superstar if they're a 300-plus hitter, but yet somehow conversation that doesn't lead to immediate success, we look at it as, oh, it's just talk, where some of that talk is really producing some action, which I can report to you from observing it from social research and people approaching this from different ways. So the first answer to your question is for people to take it as their personal responsibility to affect what in collaboration more tomorrow than they did today. And not just in the sense that I've always wanted to pursue it as from the beginning, this of how would we be responsible for all of us, 100% of humanity. But sometimes that's just a little too big to take on. Maybe it's making my world work for 100% of mine. You know, how do we get collaboration within our families, within our communities, because we have a lot of infighting in our own communities before we even start talking about the us and them problem, which is a whole other thing. Does that begin to take us down that subject of what is it we're going to do to get everybody involved in the solution of more collaboration and agreement than we had yesterday?
You know, I listened to that, and it really makes it pretty simplistic when you think about it. You know, when it comes down to taking action as individuals, we all have the capacity to do something in this day, like today, tomorrow, moving forward, to do something good for humanity, right? Do something good for other people. That's really a simple thing.
It's so satisfying to people to address that insignificance we all feel in life. You know, is my life, does my life really matter? Right? We've had a lot about the word matter and whose life matters. And, you know, every single life matters. And when we turn our attention to how to create agreement rather than to get agreement, right? It's a very different thing. How do we expand choice rather than where are my choices? The rub-off effect that I can report on myself and other people is there's such a great sense of worthiness and satisfaction that goes with that. You know, even from a selfish perspective, it's good to do for other people is the conclusion of that.
So Daniel, you know, I do consulting myself, and I sat down with a past client last night. It had been 2 years since I enacted some principles and charters and those sorts of things. And it was pretty exciting to see how far they've come as an organization. As you think about this work that you're leading and innovating, what do some of the key performance indicators look like as you march down the road, as you assess whether it's on a personal or a group level? How do folks know that they're doing this work the right way?
I think we can't leave out at the top of the list the importance of expanding relationships.
Yeah.
And being valuable to those relationships to reverse the switch of what can I get from these guys in that circle that I want to be part of or further my career or my business or organization, whatever it is, and how can we be valuable to that? One of my mentors said, you know, when you walk into a room, ask yourself, what can you add to that room that wasn't there before you walked in? Mm-hmm. Which is quite a different set of questions than how can I get my piece of the pie? Which is sort of an automatic question when you're, you know, trying to advance and get going with your career and all the things that you're after and you need to pay the bills and all of that. And it's just this weird haiku sort of, you know, ninja thing to reverse that and say, what can I do to impact the room that I'm in? And of course, I don't necessarily mean a physical room, but it could be a virtual sense of that conversation of the room is what's my contribution that I can make here? And I think in reporting on my own life of times where I haven't thought like that and times where I have thought like that, so much more has happened to my individual interests in thinking about how do I make a difference? How do I add some value? It doesn't leave me out of the picture because I'm part of that picture. I become vital to that picture. And if I'm successful enough, you want to talk about a key performance indicator, a KPI, is how necessary do people think you are that if something happened to you, their life would be affected, that they would have to keep you alive and keep you healthy and come to your aid and that sort of thing.
I love that because that gets to value, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. And I love that as a KPI. And that can withstand a number of different tests, but I love that one. And if we're thinking that way, it does change the way we operate significantly.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that, again, I said at the beginning of this, there's a lot of onion to peel here, right? Mm-hmm. So if you ask me about some of the negative reaction that I've had, that's a whole conversation we can have. But one of them that I would pick out of that conversation is, well, slavery happened by collaboration. So that doesn't mean collaboration itself is really a social good, right? And my response to that is, you're absolutely right. There's great evil that's happened by collaboration. There was a conference in Germany where they sat down and figured out what are we going to do with the Jewish problem and what's going to be our final solution to this Jewish problem. And that was a collaboration as well, right? So we have a lot of evil that's come out of collaboration as well as good. And so my answer to that is it's really about purpose when you get back to value, the highest value purpose, basically. And, you know, a fire can burn down your house and it can heat your house. I think we might even have mentioned this on our last time we talked about this. That being aside, I think that, you know, when you put yourself towards a purpose that you believe has value or just an interest for yourself, and you gather around you to support that, then it can actually be affected. When people say, well, it's a great idea, but how are you actually going to get that happening? You're going to get that happening, good or evil. You're going to get that happening by gathering those around you who can support it and galvanize it and make it a thing. It doesn't become a thing until it's a minimum of two. If it's just your idea, you're just a genius walking around, maybe homeless on the street with a great idea. But until collaboration takes place, it doesn't move to that very airy-fairy thing we call manifestation. Manifestation is not mystical. It's, you know, you manifest something by your collaborations and by your agreements at the end of the day. That's the ledger of whether, you know, you talked about a KPI. The ledger of humanity's KPI is basically on its ability to make agreement for whatever purpose that we choose to put that to, unfortunately, just like the analogy to fire.
Yeah, well, you don't stop drinking water because you may have seen someone drown, right?
Very good response.
I mean, yeah, that's people start to talk about stuff in crazy ways, and it's crazy, man. So yeah,
interesting. It's interesting about that crazy talk too. It didn't mean to cut you off, but it reminded me of something I wanted to talk about with you guys in particular, which is we have such a focus on exaggeration in that conversation.
Yes.
That we get ourselves away from the truth so quickly. And I don't mean just truth in a sort of spiritual sense, but even an effective everyday truth. Mm-hmm. Like, we'll literally hear people on the talking heads say, that's literally treason. And they use the word literally to enforce the fact that it's not. And so, you know, every time you can like get your antenna up when you hear somebody use the word literally and really ask what they mean by that.
Yeah, man, I'm telling you, man, that is so critical, the things you're talking about. Yeah, so, you know, the language you're using is so critical. So part of what you're talking about in that question around, you know, hey, I've seen collaboration work the other way. Well, of course you have. But it does kind of get to the importance of purpose, like you mentioned, right?
Yes.
That has to be an underpinning, and it's so foundational that I wonder if, to me, it's obvious, but I guess it sort of brings to question is, if that's not obvious to people, is that another body of work that needs to be sussed out a little further as well? I'm really obvious to me.
I think we brought this topic up, Charles mentioned as well, about value and mm-hmm. values. Your values are yours. No one can take that away from you. If there's anything that's most personal and most about identity of a human being or of an organization or of a nation or of a religion, it's about its values. There's a piece of work many people know called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Basic idea of that somebody's like scrounging for food, it's very hard for them to think about spiritual and philosophical mm-hmm. issues. I've learned a lot from that. I don't agree with everything that's said in there, but I will say that the conversation of is there enough, the actual conversation, when I sit and perhaps interview you guys individually at some point, or maybe we'll do it together, I've never done it with a team, to just ask the question of, do you think there's enough? And where we end up going with that conversation is examination of what's not enough and what there is enough of, or maybe too much of. And I've never had two people answer that question the same. It's like as unique as a fingerprint. I recently asked it of a very sophisticated piece of artificial intelligence. Very great conversation we could have about that. And the answers were unique from every other human being that I ever asked that question of. Because ultimately it gets into this uniqueness of this hierarchy of values that we have. And so if we're not examining these tools for creating change without values, which I think purpose is like your highest value, then it just becomes about power for the sake of power. Mm-hmm. And we see what the impact of that is throughout history, right? If your goal is the power, then once you get there, you go, well, what do you do with it except make more power? If the use of power is to move a boulder that's in the way of progress happening, you know, in a part of the country, or it's to, you know, change a government so it can move from this direction to that direction, which always comes from a new coalition of people, right? We always think of power as something that some little men in a corner have over other people, as if it's like a piece of war. When power comes from the ground up throughout history, from the French Revolution and on so many other examples, even to a simple little example of what happened with GameStop on Wall Street or 10 years ago in the Arab Spring, it always comes from the people, and it always is about some aspect of what those people consider higher freedom than what they had before, which universally is the highest value consistently you see, you know, throughout history and throughout, you know, different modes of thought. There's always the forces of wanting to decide what other people should do. And there's always the forces, which I think are greater, that talk about what is it that we have the right to do and the choice to do, and how do I get to express my life, and how does my family get to live, and how do my people get to live freely, and so on and so forth. So that's, I think, the distinction between, and I use these terms very rarely, but in the context of our conversation, between what I think is good and evil. I think evil is usually happening more by people, you know, skipping past purpose and being caught up in power. We see this in our politics today, versus standing up for a value or purpose, even if it's not popular.
Or, and to tag on to that, if the purpose is power.
Absolutely. Right?
And we see what the impacts of those are. Not to stretch too much on the idea of collaboration, but you shared something in a conversation that I really enjoyed this quote. You said that our survival is threatened not by climate change, tribalism, inequality, add your social fill in the blank, you know, wherever in that conversation, as we are about our inability to collaborate sufficiently to meet that challenge at the present moment. I thought that was really important in terms of the idea that it's not just that we aren't really focused on those things, but our inability, right? Versus, and I thought about this in terms of a conversation, is it our inability or is it our unwillingness, right? Because it goes back to choice being a part of that dialogue. And I think when we look at what our survival may be hinged on, perhaps it's our individual choices that we're not willing to make life better for everyone.
That's a really insightful distinction. At first, I was asking myself, is that a distinction with a difference or isn't it? And I think what it boils down to is for those choosing not to collaborate, to take that on your question, they don't see an incentive to collaborate. And that's the challenge for those of us that want to make the world work for 100% of humanity, is in what way can we find incentive, reframe incentive for those that, and I really don't have a focus on societal needs or even the world around them, but really just fill their own, you know, needs on a day-to-day basis. We have to reach those people. And I think the way to reach those people is demonstrating, not just talking. The talking matters to get the conversation going, but we also have to demonstrate over and over and over again, the value of collaboration and agreement is so much more personally rewarding than being cut off from society because I'm angry at the world, which I think there's a big thrust of anger and injustice sense amongst those people who've given up on society. You know, I talk about, particularly in America, but around the world, there's the left and the right and the law. I think the law is what holds society together, and it's what truly represents the people, not the people who are occupying the legislator positions temporarily. The law is what really holds a nation together. And of course, there's a lot of unjust law. I'm talking to a lawyer here, so you can understand and relate to this for the audience much better than I. But I think that we have to create an incentive for people to find not only safety in law and agreement and norms and customs and institutions and all those things that have been so torn down over the last 10 years, maybe even over the last 30. We've got to find a way to revitalize those by creating something where people have responsibility to remake those laws that don't work rather than tearing it down. And so I don't know if this answers your question about choice or inability. I do know that creating wealth, creating survival is about expanding choice. Many of us feel we have limited choice and things are forced upon us. Almost every conspiracy theory you hear from the left or the right is about how my choices are limited by others. We have to figure out a way for people to not only realize they have more choice, but even through our efforts, expand their choice. This is really what it means to create collaboration agreement for others. And even for myself as a byproduct is to create more choice for everyone. I don't exactly know what that looks like in every situation. How could I? If we're talking about water scarcity in Mississippi right now, it's a very different set of issues to how to create choice there compared to, is there enough hate? And what do we do to replace that with something else on a general societal level? Does that answer that distinction question? Because I think it's pretty important that we understand this distinction because our survival is threatened. And our survival is threatened by these things we can see coming, but we're the ones that have to do something about it. We can't, I mean, even though we work on efforts to reduce climate change and adapt to it and everything else, it's really up to us.
No, that's really helpful and prescriptive. I think part of it also is, and to your point, like we fundamentally don't think that climate change, when we think about those kinds of topics, I think people have a difficult time finding the, how does that really impact me in the moment? I think if we really look around and see what's happening in our world, we would see that it really does impact us. And certainly in the moment, I think there's change that is rapidly approaching us in a lot of ways that climate change is probably a big part of. But I think there are deeper issues that people are always trying to get to. And part of it's driven by, I think you spoke to it very well, there's just anger that a lot of people carry. And how do you deal with the anger that people have? And I think there are lots of reasons for it. There's this, you know, the inequality. I think there's the lack of ability to have access to wealth, even opportunity, even the basic things we talk about. And then what DJ and I oftentimes have conversations around, I think, is the inability for people to truly flourish. It is, you know, part of that issue as well when we talk about what makes people so angry, why are people so upset, and why are there all these things that happen on both sides of the aisle, or whatever side you want to talk about relative to, you know, if this is like, you know, politically motivated or just part of everyday life. How do we get people to be in a place, or what is it that we can do to mitigate or to help dissolve some of that anger? I oftentimes think that love is a big piece of that. And how do we love each other more versus hate each other more? But are there more sort of direct ideas that we can speak to that help deal with the idea that anger is a big problem for us all?
I think the first thing is that people don't feel like their voice matters. And so we have to figure out a way to give voice to people that we disagree with. I think we decide who we're going to listen to based on whether they're saying the stuff we agree with or not. That's what algorithms are based on. Like, people complain about the news algorithms, but they're only feeding us what we want. Otherwise, they wouldn't feed it to us, or they wouldn't make any money. We are going to have to realize that giving voice to people who are angry in a safe way and let them know that their voice matters even when I disagree with their positions is a starting value, that everybody has a voice, right? And I think that we have to bring the topic to, this is one of our six sub conversations you can discover on istherenough.org. We have the, we call it the core conversations. And one of them is values versus positions. We talked about values, how critical they are at the beginning of this. And without having to frame the word of values in a conversation, when I hear somebody speaking with great verve and patriotism for their country as a nationalist, which I think nationalism tends to be extremely destructive and prone to violence when you give it enough power. So it's like it offends me to my core, that kind of nationalism, particularly with my sense of history. But what is the value behind nationalism is the patriotism for identity, right? So I could then argue with somebody, as I might have in a previous life, about what has history shown us about nationalism and how it becomes a boiling pot for despots and you know, genocide in cases as well. So what I do instead is when I encounter somebody like that, I say, your country really matters to you, right? You feel it like a sense of personal pride, right? And I'll give voice to that value before I discuss the position, right? You understand that your love of your country and the way you express it, part of it is the value of freedom. That's what you love about your country, right? That also means tolerating people who don't think like you too, right? Because you understand it's difficult to be a human being, to hold two different types of ideas that seem to be rubbing up against each other. And it becomes very hard to make that distinction, but you're intelligent, I'm intelligent, we can discuss these things. I do this in Clubhouse all the time. And through that, I've made friendships with people who are absolutely authoritarian in their bent. And I know when I get into a conversation, they will just go right to the fact that people are nuts and crazy. You can't trust the mob and we need a strong man in charge. And they'll literally like give voice to that conversation. And I don't expect them to change that position overnight, but I'm able to get some squeaking out of values as a bridge. I have found trying to get everybody to value love over hate only speaks to those who've already crossed that Rubicon. People who have not crossed that, the bridge is validating their values before I ask them to come over and see some of the, I'm not going to call it hypocrisy, but sort of the complexity that goes with that very simplistic position that they're holding. Does that begin to answer your question?
No, I think you're spot on, because I do believe that part of the issue is we all in some shape or form don't feel heard. And I think when we take the time, and it's very difficult, I think, in some respects, you know, because I think there are very, very, very different opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of the conversations. And, you know, people have very locked in entrenched views and perspectives. I know I do sometimes as well. And so, you know, it's difficult to actually hear things that on the surface you say to yourself, that's absolutely ludicrous. It makes no sense.
Right.
And how can you want to have that perspective or view?
Right.
But to try to come over to that side for just long enough to validate that human being, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about another human being in these conversations. It's probably really important to do.
Yeah.
If there's any chance ever to get validation for your own views and perspectives and what you believe. So I think that's, you know, a very, very good truism.
So, you know, I don't want to be a adverse advocate, but I'll mention this part. That is definitely a body of work that most likely needs to be executed. You can also become exhausted engaging in that. There is a separate body of work that's arguably equally or more important around those folks who are the victims of that thinking, being pulled from self-preservation and crisis into flourishing. That's a whole separate body of work that doesn't involve that nationalist perspective, right? Trying to change their point of view, trying to convince people who are entitled to become more tolerant. That's one body of work. There's another body of work that focuses on those folks that need to be pulled from just trying to meet that lowest level of needs and rise them into baseline flourishing. That's where I'm finding my interests much more aligned these days. A lot of the consulting work I'd done in the past, and even as a practitioner working for someone else, was that convincing, Daniel. And I understand that's really important, and you can change some minds and perspectives. At the same time, there are folks who are victims of all of this. So as I kind of moved into teaching and other aspects of my humanity, that became my focus. I say all of that to say, in October, I've been invited to speak at a conference in technology. And Charles and I talk a lot about purpose. Mm-hmm. In some of our conversations, I'm sure Charles will go offline and think about it, as will I. And even in the conversation we initially had with you, sort of engaged me a little bit differently in terms of how I would approach this conference. And it wasn't as much an event as it was a launching pad for something much more sustainable. I simply could go as a speaker on leadership, talking to these thousands of Black men in technology, and be done with it. But I shifted all of that and said, this is simply a launching pad and an introduction to something that could be a lot more valuable. So that said, as you think about something like that and the purpose that someone like me could have in that, what are some of the things that come to mind, even for other folks who are in my position, to shift that thinking from, let me just go in and treat this as an event, to the expanded resource mindset, expanded choice mindset? What are some of the things you'd be thinking about as you're entering into something like this?
I don't remember if we're on video for this, but if you're seeing me smirk, it's because asking me something about how to present to a group of people, that's like talking dirty to me. It's like,
I'm not trying to talk dirty to you.
I just love that.
I'm trying to be clear.
Because one of the things what I do with difficult expression, and I'm dealing with, you know, several themes and values, is I say, pick one. Mm-hmm. What is that one idea that if they leave with nothing else of what you just said, what would that one idea be? And I further take that down into the sections of my talk of what's the one idea of each section that leads to the conclusion of the bigger one, right? And so I think that's a question for you to address, just to throw that out there. I also think, I hope I'm not talking about changing any minds with the conversation we're talking about. I think what I'm hoping to phrase is that we can change choices and conditions by which people can exercise their life in, which is a slight difference than trying to change anybody's mind, right? I'm not after changing their opinions. Hold on to your opinions. Hold on to your values. I don't want to change them one bit, even back to the nationalist example we brought. But what can we do to live in a world that doesn't end up in violence?
Yeah.
Right? I think that the victimhood conversation and the victimization conversation is one of those areas where we need to hold two ideas at the same time. And as human beings, we're capable of doing that. We absolutely need to redress history. We also need to exercise more choice. I say in the book that I'm writing, which will come out next year, maybe we can talk about it when it comes out, is that unless we confront identity, we're not going to understand any of this stuff that we're talking about well enough to actually apply. It might sound good to 100%. Listen to on a podcast, but if we don't confront the identity issue, none of that's going to take place, because I can know something intellectually but not apply it if it confronts or interferes with my identity, particularly social identity.
Yep.
So I'm not a psychologist, but I simplify identity from its much greater complexity into just two things. We are our history, and we are our choices. And so when it comes to the stuff that we can do going forward, we have to say, what replaces our victimhood? with something else that we have agency over. This is the word agency that we don't understand enough, because it's really what power is about. We think of, again, I said earlier in this conversation, of power being controlled by, you know, some people in the, you know, top echelons of society and all of that stuff. And, you know, these guys control Hollywood and these guys control Wall Street. And sometimes it's, you know, thought to be the same people. And in fact, you know, we all have agency through this magical thing called collaboration and agreement. I think of, you know, I'll put my hands up here in case we are visual. I think of it like as the Spider-Man, you know, stuff, you know, that comes out of your hands to create things. That's the power of agreement. We really don't understand. I don't think I barely understand what this stuff really is about when it comes to agreement, making and producing agreement, not trying to get it like it's a war. And so I think whatever you can pass on is that they all have agency, or they wouldn't be in that room even asking the question that they're asking in their mind right now, listening to you. Because the real question of, is there enough, our conversation, is what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it is not a victim's question. It's not a suffering question. It's about, where do we go now that we've got this far, whatever took us this far, whatever inequities we had this far, what are we doing from here? We don't have to have an answer to that immediately, but we do need to begin to own that question. What are we going to do about it? Because if we don't, you are going to tell me about your suffering in your culture. I'm going to tell you about my suffering in my culture. And we're going to end debating whose was worse and who needs to be more redressed. And I just don't think that takes us too far in the realm of creating choice.
Well, Daniel, everything you're saying, and Jessica, who's our producer, can attest to this. She's actually doing some work for me on a website. Everything you said is aligns 100% with my line of thinking, personally. And again, I never want to speak for Charles, but we talk a lot about these subjects, and this whole agency accountability is really important. I do think everything starts with self-identity.
Yes.
And oftentimes there are competing self-identities that can be in conflict, and that's where crisis births, et cetera. But it does start with self-identity. And when you tell me about your self-identity, I can probably tell you a lot about your ability to self-actualize.
Right.
And that agency, flourishing is that road to self-actualization, and agency is a critical part of that. So I 100% agree. And I appreciate your input on that agency conversation, because I do think that's a really good springboard for what to discuss in that room. Because there's also, agency isn't always aligned with self-identity. Mm. So how do you create that alignment so you can monetize, you know, your true agency, et cetera, right? That's a big part of it. And always working for someone else necessarily isn't the way to do that. And then if we're all in this room and we leave looking the same way that we came in, we probably didn't serve the purpose of that room. And that has to do with agency as well. So I appreciate that.
You know, DJ, I was just, I won't use Daniel's term of talking dirty.
You guys need to stop with that.
I got to tell you, I was super excited to hear your perspective on how you want to address that group. And I think, you know, to Daniel's point, like you're on the right perspective and path, I think, in terms of how you want to have a conversation that will lead to perhaps choice and action, right? Agency in what it means to take this conversation beyond that room, and what impact that these men can all have on flourishing within their own lives, or helping, you know, as Daniel put, is it possible for 100% of humanity to thrive?
Yeah.
To allow others to be able to thrive as well. And I think that's always an important piece.
I think the word agency and the word choice are quite synonymous, mm-hmm. right? You want to have more agency, you need more choice. And if you want to have more agency, create choice that other people have, you're going to have an incredible amount of agency. And I also want to say, for anybody listening out there who thinks of themselves in whatever way at this moment as they hear us, as a failure, we all have our history of our failures. And we all know those, maybe more, many of us, than our successes. Right? And how do you do a reset on that, right? When your family has given up on you, your friends have given up on you, the heroes have given up on you, and all of those, we all have those moments. And I said to a family member recently about this thing about your identity is your history and your choices. I said, if an exemplary man lives a beautiful life, and then, you know, after 60 years, he comes in and kills his wife, what is his identity?
Yeah.
A killer, right? We will not really look back on that past except as, oh my God, that's so strange that this incredible man was a killer, right? Well, doesn't that work in the opposite way? Right. If I've been a killer all my life and then I make a choice to move in another direction, we've seen this happen. People have incredible transformations once they're inside prison. Few and far between, but they happen, and they're so inspiring to us because of the exercise of courage and choice that it takes to leave all that stuff behind and exercise a new choice, mm-hmm. which the world will not make easy for you. And there will be all those people to remind you of all those failures that took place. You're not really that new guy you're pretending to be. You're really that guy that I've decided that you are. So
yeah.
It's not like this is an easy pathway, but the choice is there. And those people that align with your failure are the same as those people who will align in the future with your successes that you choose. Again, the only failure in life, the man said, is the failure to participate. That's a choice.
Yeah, and we're coming to a close, Daniel. The one sort of capstone I would add to that is the more liberated we become against every aspect of flourishing, intellectual, emotional, et cetera, the less that outside perspective on our identity matters. And our self-identity starts to emerge as primary.
Yes.
And that's so important, especially if you're rightly guided, such as yourself. So that's the last piece I just wanted to add.
Well, you know, that's really vital what you just said there.
I want to tag on to that really quickly, too, because it just came up for me. I took a lot of some of your quotes, Daniel, that I thought was super relevant in the conversation I knew we would have today. And one of them is that freedom is when you have nothing left to lose. And I think that's really synonymous with what DJ just shared. Being able to be in a space where we can make choices because we're free enough that there's consequences don't really exist or matter. I think that's a great place to be, and it allows us to do things, quite frankly, that are really about something much bigger than truly just ourselves. And I think it allows us to take in consideration, you know, self-preservation doesn't have to be the mode that we're in. We can be in a mode of how do I help others to be in another space where they can flourish.
Absolutely and thrive. Right.
It's a really fun game to think in those terms. You know, some people look at it as, you know, who the hell are you to think about such big things, right? That type of stuff comes up when you dare to live that way. But it is within yourself to hold that thought, even in the presence of today, what I look at as market research. You know, somebody spoke to me recently who looked at our materials and stuff like that and said, well, you need to say it simpler, but you need to clarify X or Y, you know? And the things they wanted me to clarify would make it more complex, and was these two things you can hold at the same time, right? And at the end of the day, it's just market research, right? So I go, huh, that person didn't think it was more simple. So what could I do to convey that to the next person? You know, so every time you get something that's negative, mm-hmm. it's vitally valuable for you to figure out, do I change what it is that I'm doing? Or maybe that's the result that I want, right? If somebody who's very anti, you know, global looks at me talking about 100% of humanity as like an evil thing because it's global, which I've heard, I look at that as market research. And I have adjusted something in response to that sort of idea. For example, I say, this is a game we're playing from the ground up. This is not a world order that we're pressing down on people. And I find myself putting more emphasis on the global aspect, not less, because I don't want to piss people off, right? Yeah. If you change something just because of other people being pissed off about something, just so they won't be pissed off, they are your identity, not you.
Yeah, and Daniel, every time that feedback comes, it's just an opportunity to create more interest in your work, create a broader platform for your work. And I know that's not necessarily what we're trying to do every day, but I've run up against that as well when certain concepts are introduced, et cetera. But it's a blessing in disguise oftentimes.
We do want to listen to it, even if it's very counter.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's research, right? And curiosity is at the basis of all of this stuff. We're really posing provocative questions to then use that as a pathway to discovery. We're not trying to shove answers even at ourselves, never mind anyone else. We want to really get out there and know what's really going on in this life. It's Absolutely. Not necessarily what it was. It could be something else if we exercise choice and sustain it and bring people together around it. And that means you're going to have to sift through disagreement to find agreement. That's courage that is required for that. And we're all capable of more courage. Courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is the willingness to act in spite of fear, in spite of, oh, people might not like what I'm doing or look down on me or remind me of my past or whatever they want to do to have their identity be valued, right? Because when people have a vision of who you are, that becomes part of their identity to continue to express that and find reasons why that's always going to be the way it is. We like to tag everything because the world is so complex.
Well, you've done it again. We've come to a close, but we're probably going to have to ask you back at some point.
That would be great. I think this stuff will develop. And I will encourage both of you and any of your listeners to jump into this conversation, particularly on Clubhouse, or listen to it on YouTube or Facebook when we broadcast on Clubhouse. You'll find a link to our Clubhouse schedule on istherenough.org as well. And you two would be so welcome to jump into that conversation on a number of topics that you see us developing there. And, you know, we have some coming up in October, November that are really exciting. Definitely one of those is going to be, Is There Enough Justice, either in October or November. And I would love your assistance on that and a few other topics that I know are close to your heart.
Yeah, we'd love to. I think Charles would too.
We definitely would love to. And Daniel, this is an ongoing conversation. Yep. You know, I think that we can continue to have this dialogue because I think we're all focused on how do we have a better impact. And I think it's going to take all of us to continue to think about how we do this better, how we continue to impact others with this work and for others to hear more about this work. So we'll consider you to be, you know, a regular guest that's going to show up from time to time. And we all talk about these things and we'd be happy to join your conversations as well. So appreciate you being on. And thank you all for joining us on The Conscious Vibe.
Thank you for joining us.
And check us out on tcvpodcast.com.